Grant quickly worked out the intricacies of the flitter gig. It wasn't difficult, since Filboid had removed most of the electronics from the space plane. It wasn't all that much different from driving a wag. But Grant's piloting was less cautious than Filboid's. He kept the craft's altitude low, skirting rock formations and sometimes passing between outcroppings. Filboid had warned them that Majira's patrols would be out, and since the stealth capacity of the TAV was exactly nil, Grant was making it as difficult as possible for heat-tracking devices to lock on to their burn emissions. Kane looked down at the rugged terrain flashing by beneath them, then cast a glance at Bridget. He half expected to see her eyes screwed up tight with a white-knuckled grip on the edge of her seat. She had reacted in such a fashion during a flight from Russia to Mongolia nearly 2 years ago. But now she watched as the canyons and rocky crags blurred by so quickly they became mere ripples of contrasting texture and color. One crater replaced another so fast it became almost impossible to distinguish one from another. Grant turned the joystick and the flitter gig declined farther toward the moon's horizon.
Kane
leaned forward and looked over his shoulder. Far ahead, dark mountains rose against the dark, star-speckled sky. The highest peak looked like an impossibly huge church spire.
Yeah, impressive. Not the mountains, this side of them, at about 12 o'clock.
Kane peered through his visor and the scratched canopy and saw the small black speck against the gray-white furrows of the mountains. It rapidly grew bigger.
Another TAV. Worse. It's bigger than this one, and I'll bet it's armed.
Kane settled back in the seat and looked at Bridget.
Hang on. I think we're in for a little rough water.
With Grant at the controls, I figured as much.
The TAV came swooping at them. As Grant said, it was larger than their flitter gig, having twice their beam and breadth. Its general configurations reminded Kane of a manta ray. Grant pulled at the joystick, and the flitter gig stood on its tail. A dark object with a flaming tail flashed by.
Missile.
He straightened their craft.
Pretty damn close, too.
He performed a swift loop and sent the little space plane arrowing forward again, lancing beneath the TAV. It veered around in a fast curve, another missile flaring from its port wing. It streaked beneath the flitter gig and impacted against a pillar of stone with a yellow-orange fireball. Grant pulled back on the joystick controls again, went up over the TAV, veered off in the opposite direction, and dived again. He opened full throttle and went skittering beneath the larger aircraft in a whipping spiral. They were slapped back against their seats, but the G-force assault lasted only a second. The pilot of the TAV seemed momentarily bewildered by the unexpected maneuver. The flitter gig banked, and through the canopy it appeared the horizon was wheeling crazily around them. Under Grant's guidance, the aircraft performed barrel rolls, loop-de-loops, and wide swinging yaws. Kane wondered if Grant wasn't showing off, since the pilot of the pursuit craft obviously had little experience beyond rudimentary up and down, forward and backward. Grant put the flitter gig into a sharp dive, pulled up equally sharply, reversing an old Deathbird maneuver he called a peel-up, pop-down. He threw the plane from side to side, trying to confuse the TAV's missile targeter. Another projectile smoked from the craft's launcher, streaking well below them and disappearing into a crater. Twisting in his seat, Kane watched the TAV tilting to starboard, curving back toward them in a wide, flat turn.
Son of a bitch!
What?
What?
Deceleration slammed the air from their lungs in uncontrollable exhalations. Then, just as suddenly, the pressure was gone. Kane could feel the vibrations of the overstressed stabilizers rattling through the deck at his feet. A queasy, liquid sensation began in his stomach, and the shuddering that racked the flitter gig from stem to stern didn't help it any.
Losing power.
Grant worked at the joystick frantically.
He's not responding.
The turbojets chose that moment to stop working, the blue flames disappearing from the vents with the suddenness of candles being snuffed out. For a long time, it couldn't really have been more than a handful of seconds, the flitter gig seemed to hang suspended between the airless sky and the lunar terrain. Then it plunged. As the flitter gig dropped, it turned and struck at an angle. It seemed to crash with the force of a battering ram. Kane's body strained against the recoil harness and then slammed back violently. All the air exploded from his lungs as he was engulfed in a thundering wave of shock, followed by pain. For an instant, all he heard were his own strangulated gasps as he fought for air and struggled against the cloak of darkness settling over his mind. He fought back to consciousness with the sound of the wind keening in his ears. A moment later, he realized it was the hissing of oxygen filtering into his helmet. With throbbing muscles and dazed senses, he fumbled with a release catch of his safety harness. He managed to free himself and heard, with relief, Grant mumbling a curse and Bridget biting back a groan. He looked up just as the silent shape of the TAV zipped over the little craft it had just crashed. They had landed among a forest of monolithic rock formations at the base of a ridge. The outcroppings thrust up all around from the soil like skeletal fingers. The flitter gig had skated between two of them, but crashed into a third, the impact causing it to topple over, so there was little room for the Tav to make a vertical descent in the immediate area.
Is everybody all right?
Kane's right hip was throbbing, but as far as he could tell, no bones had been broken.
I think so. You?
Yeah, a little bruised and battered, but nothing broken. Grant?
Grant pushed himself away from the shambles of the control console and slid open the canopy.
I can move, if that's any consolation. Sorry about the landing. This damn thing was too fragile to take the kind of jockeying I'm used to.
I'm sure Phil Boyd will understand. If he doesn't...
They collected their weapons and disembarked. Luckily, the flitter gig was on reasonably level ground, so they were able to jump out without falling or stumbling. 100 yards or so away, they saw the Tav slowly descending, its landing thrusters causing lunar dust to billow out in clouds. Kane, Grant, and Bridget ran at top speed in long, dangerously high strides. They slipped and stumbled on loose rock before they managed to reach the ridgeline and plunge over it. They lay prone and peered down.
We just made it. I don't think they spotted us.
At least 10 helmeted men in environmental suits carrying heavy blasters milled around the crashed flitter gig. They looked at the footprints leading away from it and up the face of the ridge.
Those weapons don't look like the ones Phil Boyd and his bunch had. Maybe they're the plasma rifles we were told about.
Kane nodded inside his helmet, then realized his companions couldn't see his head movement.
Let's get out of range, then.
The three people quickly slid down the slope on their backsides to the floor of a valley cut between the curving outer walls of two craters. Kane led the way quickly to the spot where the valley became a tumbled wilderness of lunar peaks. They struck out through a pass. Before them, the white desert stretched northward toward the glaring, glassy brilliance of Mare Frigoris. They paused at the edge and looked behind them. There was no sign of pursuit, but that didn't mean much.
We really don't have much choice. We have to go across it, and fast.
They quickened their pace as they slogged out across the pumice plain. The ground was as yielding underfoot as beach sand. The heat it contained was easily felt, even through their insulated environmental suits. They had covered but a few miles when Kane called a sharp warning. The Tav was swinging out from the peaks on the far side of the sand sea.
God damn it, they've nailed us. There's no place to hide.
Down on the ground. Throw it over ourselves.
Kane and Grant flung themselves down immediately, covering themselves with handfuls of the powdery white pumice. Bridget swiftly followed suit, burrowing beneath the surface. Kane kept part of his visor clear so he could watch the sky. The space plane swung past at a low altitude, a half mile to the west.
I think they're gone for the time being.
The three people scrambled to their feet, brushed off one another, and continued on their laborious way. The foothill peaks of the Montes Carpatas range soon dropped behind them. The small size of the moon made its horizons always unsettlingly close. A thin line of intolerably white, bright light glimmered on the horizon ahead of them. It grew into a seething glow like a lake of molten metal, stretching across their path. It was so bright they couldn't look directly at it, even with the polarized visors of their helmets. They would have to cross an outlying corner of the Mare Frigoris in order to reach the great chasm. Bridget checked their oxygen tanks.
We've all got about 2 hours of air left. If the chasm was the site for a mine, we might be able to find extra tanks there. We don't have enough oxygen to make it back to the processing center.
They steeled themselves for the ordeal as they approached. Mare Frigoris was anything but frigid. It was a sprawling, roughly circular region in which the lunar rock had somehow been fused and vitrified to the composition of glass or ice. Whatever had caused the phenomenon, the sea of ice was a vast glittering sheet that reflected the sun's radiant light like a lake-sized polished mirror. Bridget warned her companions as they approached the demarcation point between the pumice plain and the fused glass.
Keep your eyes shut as much as possible.
Hell, I've had my eyes shut for the last half hour anyway.
Linking their hands, the three people inched out onto the glassy, slick surface of the great sheet. The fierce reflection forced itself through their polarized visors and even between their tightly closed eyelids. The heat was also so intense that even through the insulation of their EVA suits, the thermal regulator controls of their shadow suits were overwhelmed. Within seconds, all of them were perspiring profusely. Their feet slipped constantly on the smooth surface, their boot treads having difficulty finding traction. They dared open their eyes only a fraction every few minutes, trying to keep the northwestward course. But their eyes were soon so blurred and seared by the unremitting glare, they could see nothing. They stumbled blindly on, Bridget trusting her eidetic memory, and Grant and Kane relying on their instincts to keep them on course. They spoke little, hearing only the labored rasp of one another's breathing in their helmets. It felt like a furnace inside their environmental suits. Their skin dried out and seemed to flinch every time it came in contact with the inner lining of the garments. The moisture in their mouths evaporated, and their tongues felt like strips of shoe leather. They drank but sparingly from their internal water supply. It was tepid anyway, tasting like bath water. Kane, Bridget, and Grant were aware only of the slippery glass surface underfoot and the touch of their hands as they clung blindly together. Time became meaningless, and none of them could even hazard a guess how long they traversed the inferno. Grant spoke suddenly, causing both Bridget and Kane to jump.
I just opened my eyes and I can't see a thing. I'm completely blind.
For a long moment, no one responded to his comment. They just kept trudging onward.
I'm sure it's just temporary. Your rods and cones are probably overstressed.
There should only be a few miles more. Let's keep moving.
Kane's head pounding from the heat, he stumbled on, fearing that he was blind himself. Blinded, sweating, and half-suffocated, they fought their way onward, struggling to gain a foot, then a yard. No sight of anything was possible in the inferno. The fused sand underfoot crunched and collapsed in places, throwing all of them off balance. The ache of the injuries they had sustained in the crash throbbed in cadence with their heartbeats. They kept walking, focused on a single necessity. To survive, they had to keep moving. So they plodded onward, linked together, ears filled only with the labored rasp of their respiration, eyes seeing nothing but a never-ending hellish glare. Their feet dragged, and they kept themselves from falling only by savage efforts of will. Their bodies lost all feeling, numb to every sensation except putting one foot in front of the other. 1 minute, the temperature was dropping, and in the next, it seemed to increase, like a wind out of a furnace. Suddenly, Bridget came to a halt, and they stumbled on rubbery legs.
We're through.
I still can't see anything.
Me either. I'm blind myself.
All Kane could see were vague, indistinct shapes overlaid by swimming, fiery globes, but he didn't mention it. A few yards ahead of him, he barely made out an overhang of rock, so he led his companions beneath it.
Let's rest a few minutes.
It took more than a few minutes for Bridget's and Grant's vision to return and Kane's eyes to clear. They discovered themselves on a white pumice plain again. Kane took their bearings again from the sunken desert of Mare Frigoris, then they trudged on, moving through the narrowing strait between the Montes Carpatos. They were not more than a mile south of the Great Chasm. Their eyes constantly scanned the horizon for an opening into the gorge. Finally, Kane spied one, like a dark, irregular line bisecting the horizon. His heart lurched with relief.
There it is.
I don't know why you sound so damn happy. God knows what we'll find in there.
Being inside the moon can't be any worse than being outside of it. I hope.
The gorge was so deep that the blazing sunlight didn't penetrate to its bottom, which was little more than a channel filled with house-sized boulders. Shadowed, yawning fissures bisected the sheer walls. Bright streaks of metallic ores and mineral deposits gleamed under the helmet lights of Kane, Bridget, and Grant. The opening by which they entered the chasm was a mine shaft quarried out of the rock. Exposed wiring and fluorescent light fixtures stretched along the ceiling as far as the eye could see. Girders of punched steel shored up the ceiling, and from these hung cabling. Motorized gurney tracks disappeared down the tunnel where no light could reach. They clambered down into the gloomy bottom of the gorge and began walking between the jagged masses of boulders toward the distant west end, occasionally confused by the writhing shadows cast by their lights. They hadn't gone far when Kane lurched to a halt, biting back a startled exclamation. Grinning up at them from the hard-packed soil was a yellow-white skull. The sight of it raised the nape hairs on all of them.
Where's the rest of the body?
And if there's no atmosphere, how could it rot?
Kane bent over it, his helmet light casting the deep indentation scored in the bone into shadow.
These look like teeth marks. Carnobots, maybe?
Nobody answered. They resumed their tense, silent progress through the tunnel. Kane tried to keep other thoughts, other worries and fears from intruding into his single-minded march, but a few penetrated the mental wall he constructed. Grant's questions about the skull had been particularly salient, and he suspected there was only one answer. The passageway narrowed, and the three people were forced to crab walk sideways. It crept downward at a gradual 45-degree angle. Finally, the tunnel widened, and they were able to walk normally again. Irregularly shaped stalactites stretched down from above, and they wended their way around stalagmites thrusting up from the floor. Bridget gestured up at the ceiling.
That proves the moon once had water.
Fascinating. I'm more interested in finding those spare oxygen tanks.
As they walked, they felt the occasional jarring of the ground at uneven intervals, causing little showers of pebbles and dirt to patter down from above.
What the hell is causing that?
seismic disturbances, probably.
The labyrinth they followed now was a split in the rock walls, so narrow they moved in a single file. Ponderous masses of rock hung precariously over them, needing very little to dislodge them. The three people moved with extreme caution, fearing that even the vibration of their footsteps would cause an avalanche. They saw no more light fixtures. The darkness around them became complete, as if they were moving through a sea of black ink, alleviated only a little by lights cast by their helmets. The crevasse debouched into a gloomy gallery with vaulted walls of black lunar basalt. A half-dozen fissures branched out from the cavern.
According to the log of Ceramus, the citadel is in that general direction.
She gestured to the fissure. They entered the opening and again began squeezing through narrow passageways and clambering over fallen slabs of stone. The signs of excavation became less and less frequent. The fissure slanted upward after a few hundred yards. For the next hour, Bridget, Grant, and Kane moved deeper into the maze of branching tunnels and galleries that rifted the moon's undercrust. Bridget tried to steer a course, but many times they walked into dead ends and were forced to backtrack. The darkness and utter absence of anything resembling life were unrelievedly oppressive. The oxygen in their tanks ran lower, and they had to stop several times and turn down the intake valves in order to conserve it. The unspoken, grim understanding that they had to reach the citadel in order to replenish their air was the spur that drove the three people onward. Still, all of them began to feel frustration, then a touch of despair, when after following a long channel for nearly half an hour, they found it led only to a dead end. Wearily, Bridget leaned her helmeted head on the wall. She started to speak, then closed her mouth, her eyes narrowing. When Grant began a profane diatribe, she silenced him with a sharp gesture.
Hush! Listen!
To what?
Do what I'm doing!
Skeptically, Kane and Grant pressed the four ports of their helmets against the wall. The rock transmitted through the material of their helmets a distant, rhythmic throb.
That sounds like a generator.
There's a hollow space behind this, another tunnel or cavern.
She poked at the rock with her fingers, and flakes crumbled beneath the pressure.
We may be able to dig our way through.
Their only tools for digging were Grant and Kane's combat knives. The two men applied the tungsten steel blades to the rock, chipping and hacking, prying loose masses of the dark stone. Bridget cleared away the debris collecting at their feet. Their lungs burned and their temples throbbed. It was slow and painful labor, as well as dangerous. A network of black cracks spread through the wall, an ominous warning that the entire mass of rock might collapse onto them. After 20 minutes, when the knives opened a small hole, the three of them pulled at the edges, quickly enlarging it. Kane squeezed through first, helped by a shove from Grant. He shone his light around, illuminating a cavern so huge that the beam couldn't reach the ceiling. Grant and Bridget entered uncertainly, the glow of their helmet lights splashing onto a broad path on the cavern floor that led into the unrelieved darkness. The steady drone was faint, though audible, which was disquieting. Dust and grit sifted down from above like intermittent snow flurries.
You hear that, right?
Both people nodded their heads inside their helmets.
But I don't know how, unless there's some sort of atmosphere down here to conduct the sound. I suppose the rocks might be conductors.
They pressed their helmeted heads against the black rock wall, and the metal transmitted the steady reverberations clearly. The regularity of the rhythm gave them instantly the key to its source.
That's a machine. Definitely a generator.
We may be right under the citadel, then.
They started moving again. The gallery curved, turning almost at right angles. As they walked around the bend, the tunnel curved again even more sharply, then turned once more, adding to their growing bewilderment and apprehension. As they made another turn, they were startled to see a patch of light far ahead. Vaguely rectangular in shape and of an unearthly greenish hue, the light wavered and flickered eerily, at times almost disappearing, at times flaring to a lurid, momentary brilliance shot through with flashes of red and even blue. To their astonishment, they saw the ceiling of the gallery formed a perfect triangle, an inverted V like the roof of an A-framed house. It was useless to speculate about whether the shape was natural or crafted by intelligent hands. They continued forward. As they drew closer to the light, they were relieved to find that the lunar crust sifted down less frequently and the illumination down the passageway grew more steady and distinct. The gallery ended as if on the brink of a precipice. The three people stared down through an abyss glowing a sickly yellow-green and into a chasm as wide and as deep as the drop-off on the plateau of Cerberus Redoubt. But the walls of the cliff face were sheer, straight, and smooth. At the bottom, more than 1,000 feet below, spread the bare, level floor of a cavern that stretched out beyond their ability to see. There was such an atmosphere of unreality about it all that only by degrees could Kane absorb the details. On the gentle curve of the ceiling, which arched a few hundred feet above them, there were fantastic sculptures, vaguely man-shaped and standing out sharply in cameo. A multitude of greenish-yellow elongated rods hung from the ceiling like glowing stalactites. Small round openings like ob ports perforated the opposite wall. At least a minute passed in silence while he, Grant, and Bridget stood there, spellbound.
What the hell is this place?
I don't know. Some kind of memorial, maybe? A work of art? I really don't know.
A narrow ledge followed the line of the right-hand wall, pitching toward the cavern floor at an ever-steepening slant.
We can go down there, or we can go back.
The three people looked at one another expectantly.
The longer we stand around here, waiting for one of us to make the decision, the more air we use.
Smiling wanly, Bridget inched out onto the narrow parapet, flattening herself against the rock wall, digging her fingers into the fissures and crevices. After a moment of hard swallowing, Kane stepped out after her. Grant followed. The ledge made a turn to the right after a few steps, and its pitch descended at an increasingly sharper angle. Grant, Kane, and Bridget were forced to edge along it with their hands gripping the wall tightly. It was a slow, perilous journey, because the lip of the ledge crumbled beneath their combined weight. All of them feared the entire walkway might give way altogether. The ledge gradually widened into a true path. The three people breathed easier when they no longer had to inch sideways. The parapet met and joined with an unnaturally smooth floor. It led to a blank wall, featureless except for a man-sized cavity that had been punched through it. A heap of debris lay beneath it. Black scorch marks around the jagged edges indicated the hole had been made with a high explosive. They inspected the area around the wall, and Kane saw a dark shape humped up in a corner. He stepped over to it, lifting away a square sheet of canvas that was draped over a number of bulky objects. He found metal rakes, a collection of picks and shovels, and the metal cylinders of a dozen oxygen tanks.
Ceramus's excavations reached this far, at least.
His first surge of relief was replaced by dread when he picked up an oxygen tank and saw the gauge's needle was frozen at zero. Bridget and Grant joined him. While Grant opened the crates, Bridget helped Kane examine the tanks.
We've got some demolition charges here.
Grant held a pair of flat discs the size and shape of saucers. Red buttons protruded from the tops and suction cups extended from the undersides.
Wonderful. We can blow ourselves up instead of suffocating.
Bridget uttered a short, wordless exclamation. She hefted a tank in her hands.
Oh, this one is full.
Kane eyed the cylinder critically. Even by dividing its contents equally between them, they were only buying time, not saving themselves. But since it was the only option available, it was the best option. Bridget went to work detaching the feed lines from their back tanks and replenishing them. When she was done, they all had another hour of relatively easy respiration. After that, it would become decidedly uncomfortable. As the fresh air filled his helmet, Kane inhaled gratefully. The painful throbbing in his temples slowly ebbed. He turned toward the hole in the cavern wall.
Let's get moving.
He stepped through the cavity first, noting that Bridget carried the oxygen tank and Grant had slipped two of the demolition charges into pouches on the outside of his EVA suit. He didn't ask his companions about it, assuming both people had their reasons. They found themselves in a short tunnel that became a doorway into a vastly wider space. Kane looked around, casting his helmet light into the shadows. A little farther along the passageway on either side of an archway loomed a pair of strange statues of a brassy metal, both about 12 feet tall. They represented creatures almost exactly like the corpse of Enlil, inhuman but with strangely noble features. The figures stood, each with a slender arm raised as though to warn Kane, Grant, and Bridget back. Upon the pedestal of each statue was a lengthy inscription in cuneiform characters.
The Anunnaki.
He came to a sudden stop and Bridget nearly trod on his heels. She started to speak, then fell silent, her face a mask of shock in the glow.
Their tomb.
All around them, dark shapes loomed up. Blurred as they were by the dense shadows, they looked like hideous travesties of humanity. Taller than Grant, leaner by far than Kane, double rows of lizard things sat upright on thrones, their bowed, powerful legs tucked beneath them. Bridget, Grant, and Kane stared wide-eyed, stunned, shocked, and awed, and terrified. The Serpent Kings had been buried royally, each one carefully embalmed and positioned upright on a funerary throne, wearing all the trappings of the godhood they had assumed upon Earth. The beautifully polished stone of the ceilings and walls had been carved in reliefs showing events in the lives of the various Anunnaki, who sat stiffly all down the length of the great hall. Grant, Kane, and Bridget could easily imagine carpets on the cold floor and a great deal of ornate furnishings. But all of that ancient splendor was long gone. The excavations of the human explorers had caved in the rock-cut chambers, and the explorers themselves had taken all the funeral finery. Only the thrones and the serpent kings remained, shriveled corpses staring into nothingness. The three humans gazed at the cadavers, their flesh crawling and their minds reeling with conjectures.
The pantheon of Sumerian gods. This is what Phil Boyd meant when he said they found them.
Let's get the hell out of here.
The Hall of the Dead led straight ahead. The three of them moved as fast as they dared, watching for cracks and splits in the floor. There seemed to be nothing but shadows behind them, and ahead of them only murk. The tomb opened suddenly into a vault-walled chamber of huge proportions, so vast that its nether end was lost in the shadows. The floor was so flat and smooth they knew it had been leveled artificially. A broken ring of cyclopean blocks stood alone. Silently, they wended their way around them. Kane glanced up, trying to see the ceiling. Instead, he saw a wedge of starlight far above. Beneath it, a shelf of stone jutted out, allowing access to the opening. He gusted out a relieved sigh.
I think we're almost out of here.
The three people quickened their pace. As they came around the base of one looming mass of stone, they were suddenly confronted by three Carnobots. The lights shining from atop their helmets gleamed dully against gray alloyed flesh. Red, multifaceted eyes stared expressionlessly at the three people. Then they sprang, their needle-like incisors glittering briefly in the glow of the lights. Grant and Kane immediately squeezed off shots with their copperheads. Sparks jumped from the droid surfaces as the bullets ricocheted away. The trio of Carnobots didn't move for a moment, their immobility puzzling. Then Kane saw a pack of the unearthly gray automatons come racing out of the shadows from behind the three. The uncanny silence in which the creatures advanced was more blood-chilling than if they'd howled like wolves. Their fangs gleamed brightly against the murk. Kane, Grant, and Bridget knew if they were bowled off their feet by the horde, the vicious talons and teeth would rip the Kevlar weave of their environmental suits, and all of them would die, either by asphyxiation, freezing, or decompression.
Make for the ledge!
The three people lunged forward, sprinting through the shadows and boulders toward the shelf-like projection of rock. Kane didn't look behind him toward the droids, but he doubted they could reach the ledge before the mechanoids overtook them. The Carnobots closed in on them by leaps and bounds, and the ledge was still 100 feet ahead. Kane felt certain they could never reach it before they were overwhelmed. Then Bridget made a diversion. She whirled, opening the valve of the oxygen tank, flinging a plume of frozen atmosphere. The creatures in the lead recoiled in momentary confusion, their vision sensors coated by frost. The respite gave Grant and Kane time to reach the ledge and bound atop it. The top was nearly 10 feet above the cavern, but the diminished gravity allowed the powerful leg muscles of the two men to propel them to safety in a single jump. Bridget's leg muscles weren't as powerful. She managed to throw her upper body over the ledge, but she began slipping backward almost immediately. Grabbing Bridget by the forearms, Kane hauled her up onto the flat slab of stone an instant before a droid's jaws would have snapped shut on an ankle. The pack reached the base of the ledge and slammed into one another in their eagerness to get at the three humans above them. Grant used his copperhead as a bludgeon, knocking them backward. The 8 Carnobots retreated hastily from the ledge, regrouped, and charged again. Kane joined Grant at the edge of the shelf, and for a few seconds they pounded and clubbed at metal skulls. The creatures backed away again, then crouched below the ledge to wait.
What can we do now? We try to climb out. The bastards will pull us down. They can just sit there until we run out of oxygen.
I think we have a more immediate problem. I don't think those things are just allowed to wander loose down here. They'd run out of fuel eventually. Somebody let the hounds out, and I'm sure they'll be along.
Kane bit back a curse, fighting the impulse to trigger a long burst at the mechanoids with his subgun, but he doubted the bullets would penetrate their metal sheathings. He looked beyond the pack of Carnobots, toward the way they had come. For an instant, he saw a glimmer of light against the tapestry of black shadows.
I believe they're on their way now.
Grant glared in frustrated fury, first at the Carnobots, then at the distant glimmer of light. He gripped his subgun as if he were seriously considering leaping down about the droids and doing as much damage as he could before they dragged him down.
Don't get any crazy ideas.
Yeah, that's my department.
Grant swiveled his head to look at him.
Then come up with one fast.
Kane's eyes followed the line of the ledge to where it melded with the cavern wall, then looked up at the cleft 15 feet or so above him. On its other side, he saw rock walls looming against the starlit sky.
That hole leads back up to the gorge.
So?
Even if we manage to get up there without being eaten, we still have those damn things on our trail.
Unless we get them off our trail and get out of here at the same time.
From the pouch of his EVA suit, he removed one of the demolition discs.
My thoughts exactly.
Bridget looked toward the lights again. They were no longer so distant and had resolved themselves into several bobbing balls of yellow-white luminescence. They were obviously attached to helmets, and she counted at least 10 of them. Grant placed the disc in a narrow gouge that ran like a fault line across the breadth of the ledge.
I don't know if there's a timing sequence after the button is pushed. I don't know if it works at all.
What do you suggest?
Grant gestured to the deeply fissured wall.
You two go first. I'll keep the droids back. Once you're up there, I'll make the climb and you can keep those damn hounds from snacking on my ass. When I get to the top, I'll shoot the detonator.
Neither Bridget nor Kane felt inclined to question his confidence about making such a difficult shot. The man's marksmanship was uncanny, as they both had reason to know.
A sound plan?
Not quite as crazy as I'd like, but it'll do.
Without hesitation, Bridget began clambering up the rock face, her gloved fingers seizing handholds. Aided by the lighter gravity, she literally swarmed up the stone wall. Slinging his subgun over his back, Kane climbed after her. Some of the handholds were mere cracks in the porous stone, but he wedged his fingers in and pulled himself along, the top of his helmet only inches from the soles of Bridget's boots. Encumbered by his helmet, he couldn't turn his head to see if the Carnobots were making an attempt to scale the ledge after them. He guessed not, since Grant's respiration hadn't changed.
Anything going on?
The droids are just sitting there watching you. They're not moving. Something I can't say about that patrol. They see us too. They're spreading out. Maybe you two ought to speed up your progress.
Kane straightened swiftly, planting the top of his helmet firmly against Bridget's backside. She started to voice a protest.
Just go in the direction I'm pushing, Babsy.
Where have I heard that before?
Working in tandem, the two people heaved and scrabbled their way upward. The pressure on top of Kane's helmet disappeared, and he dragged himself over the rough edges of the opening. He glanced quickly around at their surroundings, seeing the walls of the gorge rising steeply on either side. Then he hitched around. Panting, he lay on his stomach, peering through the hole back down into the cavern. Grant was backing slowly toward the rock wall, his attention fixed on the figures flitting like shifting shadows through the gloom.
Come on!
Wheeling, Grant suddenly kicked himself up from the shelf of rock and began scaling the wall with almost frantic haste. As if his movement had been a signal, a Carnobot lunged up from the cavern floor, pulling itself atop the ledge. Another droid appeared.
Hurry!
Grant snarled wordlessly, twisting so he faced the cavern. He held onto the wall with one hand while he pointed the subgun down at the demolition disc.
No, you're too close!
Kane threw the upper half of his body into the hole, groping for Grant's hand, just as the man fired a single shot. The demolition charge erupted in a flash of orange flame and white smoke. The concussion shoved Kane backward out of the opening and against Bridget. Ugly black cracks spread out in a spiderweb pattern around the cleft. Then the entire cliff face appeared to be in motion, collapsing in on itself. Bridget and Kane kicked themselves backward as a seething avalanche of rock slabs and lunar dust cascaded down the steep face of the gorge wall. Their surroundings gave a convulsive lurch like a ship's deck during a gale at sea. Then he was pitched headlong to the gorge floor and the ground heaved beneath them. He heard the rasp of panic in Bridget's respiration as she tried to clutch a spike of rock. She struggled to her feet, only to be hurled down again. As Kane reached for her, his ears rang with the clangor of rock striking his helmet. A huge slab of stone crashed down from above, and from beneath it spread a pattern of cracks in the gallery floor. A broad black fissure opened, and desperately, like mountain climbers on a crumbling precipice, they tried to hold their balance. In silent horror, they watched the fissure widening and spreading out, and then the ground collapsed beneath their feet. Kane heard Bridget's cry, and he felt himself falling. He didn't fall far, or for very long. The wall of the fissure sloped at an angle of 30 degrees, so that while rolling over and over in the lighter gravity, he was spared a direct perpendicular drop. He didn't grope for very long. A breath-robbing crash numbed his body, and he was only dimly aware of tumbling head over heels down the slope. The vibrations of tumbling, rolling rock slowly faded as the avalanche bled itself out. Settling stone continued to click and grate. Lowering his arms, peering through the thick pall of dust, he saw a vast heap of broken earth, shale, and titanic boulders completely filling the cleft. Bridget pushed herself up from beside him, brushing at the dust occluding her visor.
Grant!
She rose to her feet, lunging for the rock slide, but Kane grabbed her by the arm, pulling her.
It's no use. We can't dig through that.
Bridget struggled to free herself from his grasp.
He may be hurt.
He may be dead.
She stopped trying to free herself, turning to face him. Her eyes glittered like wet emeralds within the shadows cast by her helmet.
I don't believe that.
I don't either. But whether he is or isn't, we can't help him from here. We won't be able to dig through a fraction of that mess before our oxygen runs out.
Brigid gazed steadily into his face for a moment, then nodded, her shoulders sagging in resignation.
You're right.
Kane turned toward the gorge stretching away before them and eyed the sheer walls curving overhead. He estimated they towered at least 1,000 feet.
It'll take too long to climb out of here.
Brigid gestured to the gorge floor stretching away in front of them.
That's the only way we can go.
Kane took the first step and sank knee-deep in loose lunar dust. He reached out for Brigid's hand, and she grasped it tightly.
Whatever you do, don't let go.
Funny. I was about to say the very same thing.
They exchanged quick smiles, then began walking. The dust lay in the gorge like snow. It was up to Kane's neck in most places, and in long stretches it was completely over his head. The path had to be broken, not walked. Even in the lighter gravity, it was like trying to stride through a corridor composed of spun sugar. The ancient gorge became deeper as they moved southward. They marched beneath the surface of the white crystalline powder. There was nothing for either of them to see but the blank white dust around and above them. At any rate, they were invisible to any patrol craft that might cross the gorge overhead. They lost track of time as they trooped on through the passageway forged by their bodies. Kane surreptitiously turned the valve of his air tanks, reducing the flow of oxygen. Brigid turned down her own oxygen outfeed, so they had to stop frequently to rest. At their fourth stop, Brigid tried to see where they were.
Lift me up so I can see how close we are.
Kane heaved Brigid up so she stood in a stirrup he made of his linked hands. Almost instantly, she recoiled.
We're almost inside the city.
Do you see anybody?
Brigid raised her helmeted head more carefully until her eyes were just above the surface of the cindery dust. She looked around, her heart beating fast with a mixture of fascination and fear.
Only a wall. Let me down.
Kane complied. Their nerves were stretched taut as they moved on through the white blanket. At Brigid's direction, they veered to the northern side of the channel. A few minutes later, their advance through the cinders was stopped by a solid wall of dark stone.
This is it.
They pulled themselves up by the wide cracks between the huge stone blocks, thrusting their heads out of the dust. Black, square structures loomed on both sides of the channel. The collection of buildings looked eerie in the eternal twilight. The city was in ruins. Great blocks of basalt and granite had fallen from the buildings, and broken statues lay in the lunar dust. Less than a quarter of a mile away towered the citadel of the Serpent Kings, a titanic black bulk dominating the buildings like a thundercloud. Kane looked at it, feeling fear and hate-filled loathing rising within him. He knew without really knowing that the citadel had looked the same for countless centuries. On Earth, the attrition caused by the elements, the friction of moving wind and blowing sand, eventually crumbled even the strongest structures. Here, no atmosphere had ever carried water vapor to condense as rain and snow that would eventually erode away even mountains. The tower rose arrogantly, the stonework tapering in close at the top, and on its highest point was a glinting of a reflective object like a captive star.
Are we going in or not?
Unless you'd rather suffocate out here, I think we'd better go in. We know Ceramus got this far. We can only hope we can find another air tank or two.
Kane cleared out a small cavity in the dust to give them room for maneuvering. They pulled themselves to the top of the wall and saw it was an outer barrier with another wall a few yards beyond it. The inner and outer walls were joined at regular intervals by load-bearing trusses of metal. Although spaced several feet apart, they formed a latticework that could be climbed like a ladder. They proceeded to climb down between the walls, their helmet lights illuminating the way. They went downward between the walls, cramped by the narrow space, until Kane judged they were level with the main courtyard. They edged their way along the outer wall until they came to an open archway. They stepped out among cyclopean masses of crumbled black masonry towering solemnly out of the lunar dust. There had once been paved streets and courtyards, Kane saw, but they were broken and covered by pumice. There had been curving colonnades, but of them there remained nothing but a few broken, lonely black pillars. Brigid and Kane had looked upon dead cities before. They had seen Karakoto, the lost city of the Black Gobi, and even the mysterious monuments of Mars. But they had never looked upon a place more somber and darkly poignant than this ruined and forgotten metropolis that brooded beneath the naked stars. The spirit of an inconceivably ancient past reached from it to lay cold fingers on their hearts. A causeway of black stone led up toward the citadel.
You scared?
Hell yes. What about you?
Terrified.
Then the situation is normal. Let's go.
Cain and Brigid set their feet resolutely upon the black causeway. Grant realized, as the explosion of the demolition charge caught him in the backblast, he couldn't escape the approaching rock slide. He glimpsed Cain staring at him through the tinted faceplate of his helmet, then a shower of shattered dark rock poured down from above. Grant flung himself aside, leaping clear of the ledge. As he fell onto the cavern floor, he reflexively turned his fall into a roll. He sprang to his feet, shielding his head with his arms as he ran toward a fissure in the wall to avoid being crushed by larger chunks of rock. He lay pinned down by the weight of the fallen stone, the slide vibrating deafeningly through his helmet. Finally, after what seemed like an interlocking chain of eternities, the reverberations of falling rock ceased. Grant strained against the stone, trying to lever himself free, but it was a useless effort. His legs were pinned down, and though he felt no distinct pressure at any one point, an ache seemed to penetrate his entire body. He could only hope that Brigid and Cain weren't caught in the slide and buried like him. By craning his neck within his helmet, he glimpsed a glimmer of light through cracks in the stone. Within a few minutes, he felt faint vibrations through the mass of rock. He guessed the patrol of men was working to clear away the rock slide. At least, he hoped it was the patrol, and not the Carnobots trying to dig him out like a piece of offal buried by a dog. Grant felt the broken rock being removed from his legs, even though his upper body was still trapped by a slab of stone. Even through the tough fabric of his boots, he felt a length of cable encircle his ankles, then cinch tight. He swore as he realized they were binding him as they uncovered him. They were taking no chances. Methodically, he felt knees pressing into his thighs, and his arms were bent back and secured in a painful hammerlock. By the time the last chunk of rock had been removed from Grant's body, his wrists were bound at the small of his back, and he was dragged ignominiously by his feet away from the heap of shattered stone. He made a couple of attempts to kick free, but the bindings were too tight. The whole cavern was brightly illuminated by powerful halogen lamps on small collapsible tripods. 10 men in EVA suits identical to his milled about him uncertainly. They looked down at him as if surprised by what they had caught. They were all tall, lean men of the same body type as the Night Gaunts, the Furies he had fought in Chicago. Even through their faceplates, he saw the unnatural pallor of their flesh. He saw no sign of the Carnobots, and he fervently hoped their metal carcasses lay somewhere beneath the tons of stone. Grant carefully strained at the bindings around his wrists and explored with his fingertips. His Sin-Eater was still secured to his forearm. Apparently his captors hadn't recognized it as a weapon and simply wrapped the cable around the end of the holster. Surreptitiously, he worked at it, trying to free it. He had lost his copperhead during the rock slide, and he swept his gaze over the armament of the men standing around him. Two of them carried spidery, rifle-like blasters in their arms. The sectionalized barrels terminated in long cylinders, reminiscent of oversized sound suppressors. He guessed they were the three-piece plasma rifles Philboyd had mentioned. The men walked around him, their expressions slightly troubled. He saw their lips moving, but he heard nothing. Either his UTEL unit was damaged, or they communicated on a completely different radio frequency. He assumed his helmet comm was inoperable, since he hadn't heard anything from either Cain or Brigid. A tall man with a rifle gestured to him with the barrel, indicating that he should get up. Grant stared up at him blankly, uncomprehendingly. The man repeated the motion, then nudged him with a foot. Grant nodded, then made an elaborate show of struggling to rise. He rocked back and forth, as if trying to get his feet underneath him. He pretended his bound ankles hampered his efforts to rise. The rifleman's face contorted in a grimace of annoyance, and he spoke a couple of words. A pair of men slid their arms through Grant's crooked elbows and heaved him upright, or they tried to. He deliberately let his body go slack without visibly appearing to do so. Despite the lighter gravity, his 235 pounds of dead, uncooperative weight took the men by surprise. When they finally managed to hoist him erect, he swayed, lost his balance, and fell down on his left side. Grant repressed a grin, imagining the kind of profanity filling his captors' helmets. They roughly pushed him onto his back, and a man knelt to untie the cables around his ankles, the hoped-for result of his subterfuge. Once his legs were freed, the rifleman gestured for him to rise again. Grant placed the palms of his hands flat against the floor and pushed himself up. In the same motion, he flexed his wrist tendons, squeezing tightly so the actuators would be triggered even through the padding of the EVA suit. The Sin Eater slid from the holster, snagging for a second on the cable, then slapped comfortingly into his palm. As Grant rose, he twisted slightly and pressed the trigger stud. He felt the pistol buck in his hand, the recoil traveling up his arm. On the periphery of his vision, he saw a man clutch at his chest and kick backward from the floor, as though performing an acrobatic trick. The round hadn't penetrated the multi-layered EVA suit, but the kinetic shock drove the man a score of feet backward. While his companions gaped at him in goggle-eyed shock, Grant made a lunging rush toward the rifleman. His shoulder clipped the man and sent him spinning completely around. Raw blue energy blazed out of the extended barrel in a wide arc, engulfing the three members of the patrol. Their bodies flamed up like torches. The visors of their helmets shattered as they fell. Grant stared at the sputtering, charred husks that had been men only seconds before and swallowed down bile. One of the men reached for him, and he dived low behind him, kicking him at ankle level. The man fell, the blaster jarred from his hands, and Grant moved in, stamping in the visor of his helmet. Three stomps broke the glass, escaped atmosphere plumed up in a cloud, blinding everyone in the immediate vicinity. Then Grant ran deep into the cavern, jerking at the cables pinning his wrists together. Bolts of blue stabbed through the darkness after him. He snapped off a shot behind him, but he knew he didn't hit anything, and more than likely the patrol wasn't even aware he had fired. Grant cursed, realizing his helmet light acted as a beacon. A stream of plasma streaked toward him. He bounded headlong into a wedge of shadow, feeling heat sear his back. He turned his leap into a somersault, dragging his bound wrists down along the backs of his legs. After a moment or two of skin-chafing, muscle-wrenching gyrations, he managed to pull his bound hands over the soles of his boots and put them in front of him. Struggling dizzily to his feet, he set off at a shambling run, heedless of where he was going. His throat constricted, his lungs labored. Hammers of pain pounded at the walls of his skull. He didn't need to consult his oxygen gauge to know he was fast running out of air. However, he was fairly certain the patrol would find him before he asphyxiated. He had moved in a perfect stealth pattern, circling outward between rocks, stalactites, and searching men so that motion detectors would have difficulty differentiating him from their own. He moved instinctively from cover to cover, from shadow patch to shadow patch, automatically placing his feet so they raised a minimum of dust and didn't dislodge loose stones. He studied places where sentries and blastermen might be lurking. After a few minutes of cat-and-mousing without seeing so much as a flicker from the patrol's helmet lights, he hunkered down behind an outcropping and worked frantically on freeing his hands. It wasn't easy, but he managed to slip the loops of cable from his wrists. Although the prospect of being plunged into impenetrable darkness made his flesh crawl, he reached up and disconnected the light attached to the forepart of his helmet. Once it went out, he was pleasantly surprised to realize he could still see, at least after a fashion. Light was coming from somewhere. Hazy and uncertain, it was just bright enough to permit him to see a few feet in front of him, but too dim to make out shapes clearly. With one hand on the rock wall, he moved through the cavern. The wall curved gradually to the left, and he saw the source of the light. A misty blue glow permeated a gallery, seeming to emanate from the walls like a fog. He entered cautiously, noting the glow was a kind of phosphorescence. As he walked deeper into the gallery, he saw drops of condensation beading his helmet's faceplate. It took his oxygen-starved brain a moment to understand the implications, and he came to a sudden halt. He gazed around, seeing the gleam of moisture on stone and vaporous steam arising from points all over the blue gallery, as he named it. The steam wafted up from what appeared to be a peat bog at the far end of the gallery, and the sight rooted him in his tracks. Grant recalled what Phil Boyd had said about volcanism in the moon, and he wondered if he had stumbled into a little pocket of such activity, like a hot springs. Grant realized if there was steam, then there was some sort of atmosphere. After a few seconds of trying to ponder the pros and cons, he undid the seals on his helmet and tentatively lifted it off. He sniffed the air experimentally, and despite an impaired sense of smell, a stench like a thousand open cesspits assaulted his nostrils. The air was thick, clammy, and fetid, but it was breathable. However, the stench was so repulsive he wasn't sure if he didn't prefer suffocating inside the helmet. Nevertheless, he stood there and inhaled slowly through his mouth, enriching his lungs. By degrees, his fierce headache ebbed, even though a sulfurous taste coated his tongue. He had no idea how there could be an atmosphere of any sort within the moon, but he wasn't inclined to investigate the mystery. He would leave that up to Bridget. A muted, stealthy sound reached his ears. A breathable atmosphere also conducted sound, and he tried to quiet his breathing. Dim shapes came into view, moving out through the haze from the right. Dropping onto his hands and knees, Grant crawled headlong into the peat bog, algae occluding his vision. He struck out for the far side, moving through the muck as quietly as he could. His boots struck solid footing, and he pushed himself across the pond. The bottom rose beneath him, slanting upward, and he lifted his head onto the bank. The patrol was behind him, and it was also turned away. Grant crawled up onto the cavern floor and kept to the shadows as much as possible. Stealthily, he slipped through the haze-shrouded gallery. Keeping always within the shadows of the outcroppings, he crept soundlessly over the cavern floor. He breathed more easily when he couldn't see so much as an outline of the patrol. He stood, just as the Carnobot sprang at him. Grant had no time to bring his Sin-Eater to bear. The torrent of flame that washed over its alloyed hide seemed to come from nowhere. The robot rose on its hind legs, wrapped in a wreath of fire. Then its body exploded outward. Seams split, spewing sparks and smoke. Bits of metal pattered down around him. Grant, too numbed to do more than gape at the wreckage clattering over the rock floor, didn't immediately respond to the male voice.
Come on! We don't have much time!
Turning slightly, he saw a medium-sized man stepping out of a fissure in the gallery wall, brandishing a plasma rifle. His hair was cut short like Newkirk's, only it was black. He wore a one-piece zippered coverall like the people he had met at the base.
Who the hell are you?
It doesn't matter right now. We both have limited time to reach the Citadel.
Grant stepped closer to him. A small circular body, gleaming like brushed aluminum, was attached to his mastoid bone. From it stretched 10 tiny wires like spider legs made of jointed alloy, each one tipped with a curving claw. Each of the claws appeared deeply embedded in the man's flesh. Grant's belly turned a cold flip-flop.
You've been tagged by the Furies.
That's why my time is limited.
The man jerked convulsively, dropping the plasma rifle. He clawed at the silver spider on the side of his neck. A halo of pale blue light sprang up and shimmered around it. The man's body swayed, and the sway became a tremble. Then the tremble turned into a spasm. His eyes remained open, but they didn't see. His mouth gaped open, but no words came out. He croaked a sound of pain and terror and agony. Grant took a hasty step back, horror filling his mind. With a faint crackling sound similar to that of burning wood, a gray pallor suddenly swept over the man's body, spreading out from the device attached to his neck. Before Grant's eyes, his flesh and clothes were transmuted into an ash-gray substance. It swiftly darkened, becoming like a layer of anthracite between one eye blink and another. The man's back arched violently, as if he had received a heavy blow between the shoulders. His arms contorted and drew up like the gnarled branches of a leafless tree as the blanket of dark gray petrifaction crept over his torso and down his legs. A ghastly, dry gargling came from his mouth. Then the gray tide covered his lips, smothering his voice. Within another pair of eye blinks, a coal-black calcified statue knelt before the podium. The silver spider seemed to have dissolved, absorbed by the same process that turned flesh to carbon. A ghostly voice caressed his ears.
He thought to escape my judgment. Like so many others, he was deluded.
He recognized the voice as belonging to Majira. She stepped out of the fissure and around the black statue. Grant's finger touched the trigger stud of his Sin-Eater. Then he became aware of movement in the fog around him. Half a dozen tall, lean men, as gaunt as cadavers, closed in on him, moving with measured deliberation. From throat to fingertip to heel, they were clad in one-piece black garments that fitted as tightly as doeskin gloves. Even their heads were hooded in tight black cowls. They bore ubalus rods in their hands. Beneath the cowls, their visages were smooth, featureless ovals. Majira lovingly caressed the gems on the band encircling her right wrist.
But as for you, the great god Enki himself will pass judgment.
Brigid's helmet light flashed its bright beam along the gloomy passage. It disclosed a maze of squared chambers and galleries that long, long ago had been hewed out of the Citadel's base. The first chamber they looked into held the wreckage of an ancient chemical laboratory. There had been racks of instruments and receptacles, but they were smashed and scattered. Cain and Brigid moved on from one great chamber to another. They saw a battery of what seemed to have once been a series of generators. Another chamber held the ruins of a pump apparatus that she guessed had been used for oxygenation. Other, smaller chambers seemed to have been living quarters.
This is the place of the Anunnaki.
They moved on along the passageway and saw the vague outlines of towering metal shapes rising out of the dimness ahead. They were big mechanisms of such an unfamiliar design, their purpose was unfathomable. One was a complexity of cogged wheels of silver metal, geared to a sliding hollow cylinder that suggested the barrel of an artillery piece. Another was a massive upright metal bulb that suggested nothing. Upon the base of each machine was a lengthy inscription in Sumerian.
Oh, if I could only read those!
Kane knew she was feeling the strain of apprehension. The knowledge that somewhere ahead of them waited the last of the Serpent Kings, and behind them Grant's unknown fate, was like a lit match on the tender flesh of her mind. Suddenly, a high-pitched whine reverberated through his helmet. He came to a sudden halt, lifting his sin-eater.
Do you hear that?
Bridget stopped and looked around.
I hear something, like the vibrations of machinery we heard before.
How can we hear it through our helmets?
Maybe we're passing through a sonic field of some sort.
Standing motionless, listening intently, Kane cast his eyes quickly around. He could see nothing but the mysterious, sinisterly silent machines towering above him in the red-lit murk. They crept forward, both people moving soundlessly. Kane took the point, walking heel to toe as he always did in a potential kill zone.
There's a legend associated with NT, something about his command of the thunder. It was so powerful it crushed his enemies.
Whatever we're hearing, it isn't thunder, Betsy.
Not yet, anyway.
The whine seemed to rise in pitch with every step they took, straining to hit an ultra-high frequency and put it out of the range of audibility. Kane almost wished it would happen. A cry of pain from Bridget galvanized him, caused him to spin around, heart pounding. She clutched futilely at the sides of her helmet.
Whatever the sound is, it's feeding through our helmet comms, turning them into receivers.
Maybe we can disconnect them.
A white-hot wire seemed to lance through his head, passing into one ear and out the other. He was only dimly aware of crying out. Over the humming sleet storm of agony in his head, he heard Bridget yell,
"The thunder of NT!"
Sound could grow too deep, too high, or simply too loud for the human ear to record. But the thunder of Enki had an unbearable depth and intolerable volume, yet the ear and the mind were keenly responsive to its resonance and did not grow numb or dull. Its terrible sweetness was beyond human endurance. It suffocated them in a shimmering blanket of vibration that was edged with fangs. Kane gasped and struggled. He was aware that Bridget held her hands over the sides of her helmet, but he didn't realize he was writhing on the floor, too consumed with agony even to scream. Domi returned the red-eyed glare of the slavering three-headed hound on the wall. She wondered briefly if they were burying their fangs in snarls or grins. At the moment, she felt like doing both. Grasping the green lever inset into the wall beside the illustration of Cerberus, she pulled it to a midpoint position. With a rumble and whine of buried hydraulics and gears, the massive sector began folding aside, opening like an accordion. It was so heavy it took nearly half a minute for it to open just enough to allow her to step out onto the mountain plateau. Sunrise flooded the broad plateau with a golden radiance, striking highlights from the scraps of the chain link enclosing the perimeter. The air smelled fresh, rich with the hint of spring growth wafting up from the foothills far below. It still carried a chill, and she shivered. Domi turned at the sound of a footfall behind her. Lakesh stepped through the opening in the sector, smoothing down his hair, still disheveled from sleep. He gazed reproachfully at her with bleary eyes.
"Darlingest one, you could have waited for me. I'm not my best this early in the morning. Besides, what can be so important that you rouse me literally at the crack of dawn and tell me to follow you out here?"
She spoke quietly, as if she feared waking the other residents of the redoubt.
"We have guests arriving."
Lakesh's eyes went wide in surprise, and then narrowed with a wary skepticism.
"How can you possibly know that?"
"A transcom call came in a little while ago. Farrell received it. He woke me up to tell me he couldn't find you."
"A transcom call? From whom?"
"Skydog."
Lakesh nodded in understanding. Skydog's band of Sioux and Cheyenne were the Cerberus Redoubt's nearest neighbors, its only neighbors for that matter. Not so much a chief as a shaman, a warrior priest, Skydog was Cobaltville bred like they were. Unlike them, he had been exiled from the Ville while still a youth due to his Lakota ancestry. He joined a band of Cheyenne and Sioux living in the foothills of the Bitterroot Range, and eventually earned a position of high authority and respect among them. Kane, on one of his visits, had entrusted the man with one of the transcom units. Though its range was limited to a couple of miles, it was better than no means of communication at all.
"So when Skydog made the call, he was already in sight of our front door?"
"Yeah."
"Why is he coming here at such an ungodly hour?"
"He's bringing something that belongs to Kane.
Bakesh frowned, becoming annoyed at the vague information Domi was supplying.
Something he left in the village during one of his trips down there? That makes no sense. Whatever it was, it couldn't have been that important.
Domi turned to favor him with an intense stare he found discomforting.
No, Lakesh. It's not something he left in the village. It's something Kane never talked about with anybody here. He never talked about it with me either, but that's because I already knew about it. Or I knew the possibility this day might come.
A chill caused Lakesh to shiver, but it wasn't due to the temperature. Fingers of dread knotted in his stomach.
This involves your captivity in Area 51, doesn't it?
She nodded once, a short jerk of her white-haired head, and she fell silent. Lakesh waited for her to say more, and when she didn't, he was on the verge of demanding further explanation when the steady clop-clop of hooves on asphalt reached his ears. Domi tensed, watching the point where the plateau narrowed down into the road. The sound grew louder, and Lakesh realized two horses were approaching, coming up the incline. Silhouetted against the rising sun, two figures mounted on horseback appeared at the edge of the plateau.
Sky Dog!
Lakesh had never met the shaman, permitting Kane to act as both ambassador and liaison. He squinted at the second figure astride a pony. Even in the uncertain light, he could see the figure was very slight of build, almost childlike. A blanket lay draped over the head and shoulders.
Who is that other one?
Domi didn't answer. She strode quickly forward to meet them. Sky Dog reined his horse to a halt and gestured to her.
Oh, Mitakola, Domi. It's been a while.
Domi acknowledged the comment with a jittery smile. She moved swiftly to the other mounted person and spoke in such low murmurs Lakesh couldn't catch a single word. He glanced up at Sky Dog. The man's face was lean and sharply planed, with wide cheekbones and narrow eyes the color of obsidian. Shiny black hair, plaited in two braids, fell almost to his waist. Behind his right ear, a single white eagle feather dangled.
I'm Sky Dog. I don't believe I've had the pleasure.
Lakesh stepped forward, extending a hand.
My name is Lakesh. I've heard a lot about you, sir.
Sky Dog's eyes flashed with surprise.
Same here, Lakesh. I have to confess, you don't look anything like the man I expected.
He clasped Lakesh's hand tightly. Lakesh winced a bit at the strength of the man's grip.
I've had what used to be called a makeover. What brings you here?
Sky Dog's face registered surprise a second time.
You mean you don't know?
He jerked his head toward the blanket-swathed figure whom Domi was helping dismount.
She showed up in my village 2 days ago, begging to be brought here. She claimed she knew all of you, particularly Kane. She said it was a matter of life and death.
Lakesh gazed suspiciously at the figure.
Whose life?
When the blanket dropped, his suspicious gaze became a gape of goggle-eyed shock. The hybrid female was small, smaller even than Domi. Her huge, upslanting eyes of a clear crystal blue gave Lakesh a silent appraisal. They looked haunted. White hair, the texture of silk threads, fell from her domed skull and curled inward at her slender shoulders. Her compact, tiny-breasted form was encased in a silvery-gray, skin-tight bodysuit. It only accentuated the distended condition of her belly. Lakesh's experience with pregnant women was exceptionally slight, but he guessed she was at least 6 months along. She held her belly with both long-fingered hands.
This life. My name is Quavel, and I have traveled a very long way in order to save it.
Outlander's Devil in the Moon is a Graphic Audio production. Outlanders and all characters are trademarks owned by Harlequin Enterprises Limited, used by others under license. Copyright 2002, Worldwide Library, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2005, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by Terrence Aselford, Nanette Savard, Thomas Penny, Richard Rowan, Kate Torrey, and Colleen Delaney. Additional red shirts by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Terrence Aselford. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing by Brian Rogers and Nathan DeBoard. Graphic audio sound design by Chris Rowan. The Outlanders theme was composed by Norman Vanderslice. If you enjoyed Outlanders, be sure to look for James Axler's Deathlands, available at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloadable extras, forums, and podcasts. Keep listening for a preview of another Graphic Audio title.
The following preview is of a Graphic Audio production rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Available now from Graphic Audio.
Deathlands 57, Breakthrough. He timed his loping stride, so he arrived at the guard station a second before the sledge did. He held out his hands, grabbing the front of the cart and stopping it.
Whoa! What do you want? Get out of the way, you white-haired runt!
All no good. Not red hot enough.
What's the holdup?
Jack reached into the cart and hefted out one of the big rectangular blocks, bending his knees to take the weight, which was considerable.
This?
The albino opened his arms. 100 pounds of nuke glass fell into the soldier's boots. No EM pulse, no deflection. Before the soldier could move, Jack took another, smaller piece of glass and slammed all 25 pounds of it onto the top of his helmet. The pulse rifle clattered to the floor beside the block. The cart-pushing slave and his partners silently backed away from their sledge and made themselves scarce, hightailing it toward the mine entrance. The trooper bent down and retrieved his rifle.
Fucking bastard! Your ass is mine!
He used it like a pry bar to lever the block off his boots. By that time, Jack was running down the side tunnel, his shoulder-length white hair flying. The trooper didn't hesitate. As soon as he got free of the block, he charged after the albino teenager.
What the hell's going on?
I'm out of here before.
A beam 50 times brighter than their badges sliced through the darkness of the cavern.
Let's go before they kill us!
The shot was high and to the right, just past Jack's shoulder.
Ha!
The draftsman's line of green light hit the wall in front of him and melted it instantaneously. At the laser's impact point, the glass immediately liquefied, and the damage spread out around the initial hole, like ice melting around a blowtorch flame. There was no steam, but there was smoke. Harsh, throat-rasping smoke. The liquid glass poured down the wall and melted with the floor as it quickly cooled. The trooper fired again, and again he missed high, perhaps because he was shooting on the run.
Shit! You suck!
Fuck you!
Fuck you!
This time, the pulse opened a 2-foot-wide hole near the top of the wall. A slave was caught in a molten glass waterfall that poured down over his head and back. He managed to stand for a split second as it cascaded over him. Then he slowly sank to the floor, his lungs scoured out. As he slumped, his flesh burst into flame. By the time Jack reached the turn, all that remained of the man were the charred bones of his legs, which stuck out of the smoking blob of glass. Trigger pinned, the soldier swung the laser rifle back, trying to slice him in two. Jack threw himself down and rolled.
If you can't find that hot Graphic Audio title you're looking for, just head to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD or MP3 disc format. Or, the fastest and cheapest way, download that puppy and play it on any of the many devices that'll play Windows Media. And if you're on the road or just a total computer feeb, snatch up the phone and call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.